As with all of Coppola's pictures, it's the layering of details that counts, the accretion of sly but not minor observations that come to form the whole, like the stippled strokes of a Seurat painting. That's Stephanie Zakarik at Time Magazine. Hopefully somebody can tell me what the hell a Seurat painting is. S-E-U-R-A-T. Yes, maybe I'm not that proficient in the visual arts, or maybe you're also wondering what the hell that is. Bottom line is this. Welcome to Cinephiles Always, episode 152. A pleasure to have you with us. We're recording this on Election Tuesday, so this is a good respite away from watching cable news for the next 24 hours, or who knows, by the time you listen to this, we may not even have a winner yet for another week. But regardless, this is your escape from the real world, where we talk movies and some good movies coming up this week to discuss. Baseball is over. I've got more time to watch movies. On the Rocks, Sofia Coppola's new movie starring Bill Murray, Rashida Jones, and Marlon Wayans will be our featured review, as you heard that Stephanie Zakarik review talking about it. The Addams Family. That's right, because we interviewed Barry Sonnenfeld, and he was such a wonderful guy, one of my all-time favorite interviews. I realized, embarrassingly, I'd never actually seen the first Addams Family or Addams Family Values. So in honor of Halloween, I watched the first Addams Family with my kids, a review of that, and a father-son movie that tugs at the heartstrings, the 20th anniversary of Frequency, starring Dennis Quaid and Jim Caviezel before he starred in The Passion. Andre Brower, too, can never do a wrong misstep. I'm going to talk about the movie Frequency for the 20th anniversary. And, of course, major news with Sean Connery passing away. That's right, Bond himself. I got a couple of good Sean Connery stories for all of you, plus news involving Maya and Ethan Hawke. And here's the big one. Irwin Winkler, legendary producer. All right, I bought his book a couple weeks ago. And as everyone knows, normally people are, you know, eager to hype up their book when it's released. So I wasn't sure if Mr. Winkler would come on the pod. Joe reached out to him. Sure enough, we got him. I cannot wait. He is the producer. 50 years. Rocky, Goodfellas, Raging Bull, DeLovely, The Right Stuff, Creed, and The Irishman. His films have been nominated for 52 Academy Awards, including 5 movies for Best Picture. It's an awesome book. I cannot wait to talk to Irwin Winkler today. And so that will be coming up here momentarily. Plus, a Mount Rushmore of father and daughter movies in honor of On the Rocks. And Joe has an incredible story about moving once again. I think he's moved like 3 times in the last 6 months. As everyone knows listening to this podcast, Joe is about as mild mannered as it gets. You're going to want to hear this story of how he lost his mind. Let's start first, though, with On the Rocks. Actually, no, hang on. Let me just check, see if we have any reviews here. Let's go to Apple Podcasts. Subscribe, rate, and review. As always, appreciate the love. This is how we keep the thing rolling. Let me see if anybody has any comments. I didn't see any tweets. You can always tweet me, by the way, CinephilePod or Adnan S. Virk. I got this here from Emil49. Thank you, Mr. Virk. Misspelled Virk. It's okay. V-E-R-K. Seamless transition sports to cinema. I'm about to watch season 4 of Fargo due to review. If I may be so bold, will you contemplate doing a different type of review? Going to cut the cord and get rid of cable, so I would love to get your recommendation regarding which streaming platform had the best collection of library mixed with new programming, please. Well, if you want like classics, Criterion is incredible, which Scott Rogowski could tell you about. I mean, Criterion's the way to go for, like, you know, great, great films of the past, and that's like a vast streaming library. But you want new programming as well. So I would think Netflix. I mean, if your choices are Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, I mean, between those three, you're probably pretty good. On the Rocks is available on Amazon Prime. I don't think they have much of a library, though, which is what you're asking about. So I would say if you want a library plus new titles, Netflix would be the way to go. I think Hulu and Amazon have more newer content, but Criterion would be obviously the one with the most movies. Joe, is that fair? You may be more up on streaming platforms than me.
I think that's fair. I think I would just also add, if you're a horror movie person, there's this great streaming service called Shudder. It has every horror movie that you might ever want, need, stuff you have heard of, stuff you haven't. And that's, I think, $5.99 a month. So Shudder is another one to look at.
Okay, Shudder, way to go as well. Okay. Also, Meh, who's been commenting a lot. Love the Jeff Daniels Mount Rushmore. My honorable mention is Something Wild. Awful movie, but it was my introduction to Jeff. Grew up in Michigan, so he's special to us. Thanks for the Comey Rule review. Been wanting to see it. Seemed too long. I'll pass on it. Like Joe points out, we're already in an election. I don't want to see the last one. Fair point. Okay, let's do a little On the Rocks here. The new film from Sofia Coppola, available on Amazon Prime. It's a light and breezy, the story of a young mother reconnects with her larger-than-life playboy father on an adventure through New York. In this comedy about aging, marriage, and the tenuous bond between parents and grown children, New York author and married mother of two, Laura, has become suspicious that her career-driven husband may be having an affair with a coworker, a speculation encouraged by her caddish, bon vivant father. I mean, who writes this stuff? That's outstanding. If you're a Bill Murray fan as I am, then you're going to enjoy the movie, because Murray, it's one of those roles that just seems to fit him like a glove. He's a charmer. He's got this grace about him, always flirting with the ladies, but also a very kind and loving father. And he's genuinely concerned that his wife is being cheated on by her husband, Marlon Wayans. The woman in question is Laura, played by Rashida Jones. And the strength of the movie really is those three performances. Like I said, Murray, these roles he can do in his sleep. If you think it's Lost in Translation, again, it isn't. Lost in Translation, he has a much more morose feel to it. You know, he had this real kind of sad countenance, and that was kind of his character reflecting on life and what could have been in this on again, off again, perhaps romance with Scarlett Johansson. Here, he's a fairly happy guy. You know, he's just an older guy. He's got a bunch of money, divorced from his wife, and like I said, likes the ladies, likes some good wine. That's about it. And he's trying to reconnect here with his daughter. And at one point, she says, you know, I wish you were taking a little less joy in this, because he does seem to be a little too excited about the fact that her husband may be having an affair. And he goes to the steps and says, okay, I'm going to have my guy tail him. I'm going to look at some purchases he made, you know, go check his phone. And Marlon Wayans' behavior becomes increasingly more suspicious, especially once Rashida Jones meets his coworker, who's an attractive woman named Fiona, played by Jessica Henwick. So you have a fairly straightforward story here. Mom and dad trying to find out if the hubby is cheating, even taking the extent of taking a very expensive trip to Mexico and having to get her mom look after the kids and so on and so forth. Bottom line is this. I enjoyed the film. I don't think it's going to be a particularly memorable movie. I think it's got smart details about it. It's got good dialogue. You always expect with Sofia Coppola's movies. The directing isn't particularly flashy. But I thought it was a well-told story and a drama with some good comedic overtones. And again, I think the key really is the trio performances. They're all really excellent actors, and they make the story come to life with charm and with nuance. I did think the ending was a bit of a letdown, and that's why a part of me says it's a very slight piece of work. You watch it and you go, that it? You're like, okay. Well, I enjoyed the journey for the 90 minutes, but it's not something that's going to stay with me. It's not something that I'm eagerly recommending to others, but it is further proof that Sofia Coppola is a much better director than she is an actress. I'm going to give it 3 Maple Leafs, again, because of the amiable charm of the 3 actors involved. Wayans, a rare dramatic performance for him. Rashida Jones always has a good comic touch about her, plays a very sympathetic woman, mother of 2. And Murray is always Murray. K. Austin Collins of Rolling Stone. It's a little zany, a little blue, emotionally jagged, adventurously all over the place. But On the Rocks definitely has some teachable moments and some good small moments as well. This is one that in the old days, Joe, you'd say, it's a good watch on cable or it's a good VHS watch. It's not one to go run to the theaters, but it's a nice, pleasant watch. I know you haven't seen On the Rocks yet, but 3 Maple Leafs. Hopefully you'll see it at some point. You were without internet this weekend because you were moving.
Yeah, I was without internet. I've said this before, but like the rest of America, I'm a huge Bill Murray fan. I love Sofia Coppola movies too, so I will definitely check it out at one point. But what I've read about it, Adnan, how does it stack up through the lens of it being a New York movie and New York being a part of the scenery and almost a character, if you will, like Woody Allen films?
Yeah, it definitely has a sense of that. I mean, you see the brownstones, you see them driving through Manhattan, you see, you know, New York cops, all the rest of it. It's just interesting to me because, you know, the New York that we love is all about community and people reaching out and touching each other. And with COVID now, you're just scared to see anybody these days. So it is interesting to see a movie like that, which people are still in groups together and no one's wearing masks. That's the one thing I was kind of taken aback by. I was like, oh, I can't wait till we can get back to this New York. Not like there's, you know, big parade scenes or anything. But yeah, definitely I would agree. New York definitely plays a character as it does so often in those movies. But I will say, as far as like Oscar bait, it's not nearly as good, I think, as Lost in Translation. And if you didn't like Lost in Translation, like my brother, well, then you're really going to hate this movie. But it's kind of like what I was saying earlier about the Trial of Chicago 7. Like, if this is Oscar bait, we're in trouble. That's not meant to be dismissive. I just think that it's better work out there. Let's move on to the Addams Family. When a man, Christopher Lloyd, claiming to be Fester, the missing brother of Gomez, Raul Julia, arrives at the Addams home, the family is thrilled. However, Morticia, Angelica Houston, begins to suspect the man is a fraud, since he cannot recall details of Fester's life. With the help of the lawyer Tully, Fester manages to get the Addams clan evicted from their home. Gomez realizes the two men are conspiring to swindle the Addams fortune, that he must challenge Fester. I'd never seen it before after reading Barry Sonnenfeld's book. And again, if you haven't read it, you should read it. Really good movie. I mean, as Joe mentioned earlier, he's a big fan of horror movies, and this is clearly a movie in which you can tell Barry Sonnenfeld is a master of the macabre. Like, in a way that Edgar Allan Poe would appreciate, the off-kilter humor, the vivid set design, the ghoulish backdrop, And of course, the unforgettable music, you know. It all kind of combines together to make a really entertaining work in a movie that I think fits well for, you know, older kids at least, 10 plus. Some of the younger boys might be a little terrified of it, but I think he's got good cast all around. The guy who really stood out to me was Raul Julia as Gomez, the late Raul Julia, with that grin on his face. He always seems to be up to some sort of mischief. And the sword fights that he has with Dan Hedaya are pretty funny. Angelica Houston's Morticia is very good. I mean, Christina Ricci. I mean, it's all really, really well cast. But what really stood out to me, especially after reading Barry's book, is what a visual stylist he is. I mean, this is a guy who got a start as a cinematographer of the Coen brothers, and he was a guy who was willing to put the camera anywhere. And there's a couple scenes here. One scene where Gomez and Fester are going down a slide, and the camera's like right on their faces flying around. And it just shows what an inventive director Barry Sonnenfeld is and why he's been successful. And the Addams Family is yet another example of the fact he's got a really strong visual style to him. I look forward to watching Addams Family Values at some point in the next week or so. But, Joe, never sure if you've seen the original Addams Family or your thoughts on it.
Yeah, no, I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. Love Barry Sonnenfeld in this. Were there any, typical... You say it holds up, but does it feel 90s? Does it feel dated in any way? In a good way, but does it feel like that?
Yeah, it's got a little bit of nostalgia to it. That's fair. Like some of the music and stuff and just the kind of general tone of it, I would agree. This is even like just the fact the cast. I mean, all these people are like big in the 90s. So there is that. But the one thing that endures no matter what, though, is Thing. I mean, just the fact that you've got like a walking hand everywhere. I mean, just even like you think of CGI and how much it's improved now. But I think for that time, just having a hand walking all over the place. I mean, at one point, massaging Raul Julia's forehead. I mean, that's, I thought it was a pretty inventive way to have a character who was awfully memorable.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I think, Christopher Hart is credited as the Thing in the movie on IMDb. So he's actually a credited cast member, his right or left hand, yeah.
What a life, right? I was in the Addams Family. Really? Oh, who were you? I was the Thing. The Thing, that's right. Yeah, just the hand. That's what I was. Okay, well, there's no small parts, only small actors. One more review before we get to some news and give a toast to Sean Connery. Frequency. What if you had the chance to travel back in time and change one event in your life? What would it be? For John Sullivan, Jim Caviezel, there's no question. He would undo the events of October 12, 1969, when the out-of-control Bruxton fire took the life of his father, Dennis Quaid, a heroic firefighter. Now John may get exactly what he wished for and much more than he bargained for. I hadn't seen Frequency in 20 years. For the 20th anniversary, I watched it again. It's on HBO this month. And I really enjoyed it, particularly the first, you know, half of the film I thought was really engaging and has a lot of elements of one of the favorite movies of me and Joe, which is Back to the Future. And the way that, you know, you're trying to go to the past, but you realize once you alter events in the past, you're altering the space-time continuum. And Caviezel plays this guy, you know, he's coming out of a bad relationship. He just goes and hooks up like his dad's old radio. And sure enough, somehow he's connected to his father. And they get to talking. Hey, who are you? I'm John Sullivan. I'm Frank Sullivan. That was my dad's name, blah, blah, blah. And yes, it is a wacky out there premise. But somehow a guy in the current day of 2000 is talking to his father, who's long dead, but it feels like it's 1969. And my favorite part of the movie is after they overcome the ridiculousness of how the hell is this happening? And because Caviezel's in the same spot as his dad, he can say, okay, well, this is what happened to you, and this is what's going to happen next, and this is what just happened. And the biggest connection is baseball. Quaid is a huge Mets fan, loves the Miracle Mets. And so he starts talking baseball with his kid, doesn't know it's his kid, and Caviezel's like, well, I don't really follow baseball anymore. And he's like, oh, what about the Amazons? Are you kidding? You live in Queens? He's like, well, yeah, I mean, the Amazons, that's different. What happened in game 2? What happened in game 3? And Quaid's going, wait, what do you mean game 2? Game 1's tomorrow night? What do you mean? How do you know what's going to happen? What is it? And that's pretty funny. Again, it reminds me of Back to the Future. Cubs win World Series over Miami, thanks to the Sports Almanac. And in this case, that's the connection. That's how Caviezel convinces his dad, because he knows exactly what's going to happen in every single game and why the New York Mets are going to shock the world and win the World Series. But that whole sequence when, just imagine you're in 1969, much like Christopher Lloyd trying to find out about the future, you know, he's asking his kid for, say, hey, whatever happened with Apollo? You know, whatever happened with this? Or what kind of cars people are going to drive? And cell phones or micro, all this kind of stuff. And it all builds up to a beautiful moment in which, you know, the father tells son, okay, you know, I should let you get going, go back to bed. He's like, yeah. And it's just so pure and so well acted on both parts. I mean, Dennis Quaid and Jim Caviezel, the way he just goes, yeah, I really missed you, Dad. He's like, yeah, I don't want to hang up. I don't want this to ever end. It's a really, really sweet movie. It really tugged at the heartstrings when I was watching it again. And Quaid is very earnest in the role. You know, picture late 60s dad, firefighter, big smile, handsome guy, pretty wife, loves to play baseball as a kid, lunchbox kind of guy, before tragedy strikes. Whereas Caviezel is excellent because he's a very introspective actor, and it's a much more downbeat performance. Yet, he's got a bit of his dad's idealism, which is definitely stoked by the fact that he thinks he's talking to his father again. And the other part of it, this is where it starts to get a little wacky. So the first hour, okay, how is this happening? Time travel, okay. But now history gets altered because of their communication. And Caviezel is a cop, and now he needs his dad's help because he saves his dad from the fire because he tells him, Dad, don't go in the fire, go the other way, blah, blah, blah. So he saves his dad's life. But now his mom gets murdered by a serial killer, and that case they've been investigating for 30 years, and Caviezel's working on that case. And so now Quaid, having saved himself, has to save his wife, Caviezel's mom, from the fact of being killed by a serial killer. So you've got this crazy plot where it starts happening where he's going to find the guy who's a serial killer and somehow intercept him or at least stop him from murdering these women. So it does get a little more grisly than you might expect. Andre Brower, one of my favorite actors, he plays one of the police guys in charge actually. At one point, he's going to bring in Quaid because he's being suspected of murder. So suffice to say, the story takes a lot of twists and turns, doesn't always work, and the ending, unfortunately, is real Hollywood pablum. The line is, kiddo, chief, I'm always here, because he always calls this kid chief. That is definitely going to be eye roll inducing. And the last musical montage was a little much for me. I swear, watching an hour in, I go, this is a four Maple Leaf movie. I'm surprised people don't talk about this more. And now I begrudgingly admit, oh yes, because the last 15 minutes gets a little ridiculous. I still give it three Maple Leafs. If you've never seen Frequency, 20th anniversary of it, if you like Dennis Quaid and Jim Caviezel, if you like the New York Mets, if you love Back to the Future, there's three reasons why I think you're really going to dig Frequency. Joe, have you ever seen it?
You know, I saw it when I was a kid, and I do remember feeling closer to my dad in that moment. My dad is still very much alive, but I do remember thinking, oh, yeah, this is kind of nice. But hearing you retell it now, I completely forgot the second half about the mom and the serial killer. It sounds like it has everything you'd want out of a movie. It just kind of sounds like that there was misdirection in the last hour of it. Fair?
And I'm glad you mentioned the direction. It's actually well directed by Gregory Hoblit because he's got to, you know, there's some especially good sequences of the fire sequences. You know, the inferno is burning, and he's got these quick cuts and slow motion and the panic and dread in Quaid's face. I mean, it's actually really well directed by Gregory Hoblit. I believe he's a TV director, might have done some NYPD Blue stuff, but yeah, there's a lot of plot. Moira MacDonald of the Seattle Times features plenty of soft focus, picture perfect father and son baseball scenes, an enormous amount of plot, and not quite enough of anything else. Nick Funnel of Time Out, this ambitious but frustrating time shift thriller, never quite manages to jam together two distinct stories, and Lisa Allspector of Chicago Reader. Quaid's buoyant earnestness complements the stunning low-key performance by Caviezel, whose close-ups give new meaning to the idea that still waters run deep. Frequency, 20th anniversary, currently on HBO. Time to raise a glass here, a martini perhaps, yes, shaken, not stirred, to James Bond himself. Sean Connery passing at the age of 90. He's always going to be known as James Bond, so here's the best story I can tell you. Ian Fleming wrote James Bond, didn't want him. First choice is Cary Grant, he turned down the role. The producers said, okay, we're going to get this guy Sean Connery. He'd been discovered in like a Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympic kind of thing. And Fleming goes, no, this guy's way too brawny and muscular, and he's 6'2". He's totally wrong for the part. Well, sure enough, Fleming was wrong. Dr. No was the first Bond movie in which Connery made an appearance as the sexy Agent 007. That was always the key. His James Bond is not only a man of action, but he's also charming and suave. It's like, as the old expression says, men want to be him, the women were in love with him. And really, Goldfinger is where I really kind of went to a new level in terms of James Bond love. But a guy who was always a little uneasy with fame, you know, he was Bond 6 of the next 7 movies, but 70s kind of fell on lean times, couple of exceptions, Man Who Would Be King is a good movie. But the movie that brought him back to life, which is my favorite Sean Connery movie, is The Untouchables. And his performance as Malone is incredible. Think about this. You've got David Mamet writing the script, one of the greatest writers of all time. You got Brian De Palma, Hall of Fame director. You got Robert De Niro as Al Capone, memorable scene with a baseball bat. Kevin Costner, the height of 80s Kevin Costner stardom. Andy Garcia, before Godfather 3, great young up-and-comer. Charles Martin Smith. I mean, you got good actors all over the place. And Sean Connery is the heart of the Untouchables. Like, he steals the movie as this beat cop Malone. And a lot of it is Mamet's dialogue. here endeth the lesson. You know, he comes at you with a gun, you come at him. No, he comes at you with a knife, you come at him with a gun. You know, that's the Chicago way. And that's how you get Capone. I mean, the whole sequence where he first starts talking to Kevin Costner, like, I can't wait. I'm going to watch The Untouchables again this week, just in honor of Sean Connery. But an incredible actor. And that really brought him back because he won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. And then he made a lot of movies that probably a lot of you know. You know, Entrapment in 1999. You know, The Rock, obviously. Finding Forrester. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was a bomb. Unfortunately, it was his last acting role, 03. Guy hadn't acted in almost 20 years. Everyone knows Sean Connery. And like I said, uneasy with fame, definitely a bit of a prick. I mean, you can do a quick Google search of Sean Connery being an asshole to a bunch of people, abusive, insulting. And also, by the way, I should mention this. I don't like to speak ill of dead, but also abusive to women. I mean, this is not a guy who I think should be a role model. I mean, I love his performances, but as a guy, I think there's a lot there to take issue with, particularly, like I said, the spousal and verbal abuse. I mean, this whole idea of, oh, man's man, well, yeah, but at times he was wrong, and it's just terrible. But then again, people say, but I loved him in Indiana Jones. Okay, fine. Well, yeah, sure. Him and Harrison Ford, father and son, that grossed to $500 million worldwide. Family business, terrible movie. That was with Matthew Broderick. So listen, there was hits and misses along the way, but The Untouchables is great. And of course, I know all of you are thinking, how about The Hunt for Red October? Absolutely. A Sean Connery, a Scot playing a Soviet sub-captain, a major hit in 1990, opposite of Alec Baldwin. A quick Sean Connery story for you, courtesy of our friend Max Bredos, friend of the pod. Max tells the story better. You can follow him on Twitter. Max Bredos says, him and his friend are in L.A. They see Sean Connery golfing. The friend says, I got to go talk to him. And Max says, you know what? Just judging by his veneer, public persona, I don't think he likes people. I don't think he wants to talk to us. He's like, no, I'm going to do it. He goes up to him and goes, hey, Sean Connery, I got to tell you, man, Zardoz, my favorite movies. Zardoz is a disaster, by the way. It's a brutal movie. He goes, Zardoz is so great. I just want to tell him, I'm a huge fan. And Sean Connery just fixes him with that glare and says, I'd appreciate it if you respect my right to privacy. There you go. Game, set, match. Buzz off. Don't talk to me. I'd appreciate it if you respect my right to privacy. Oh, too good. Sean Connery, RIP at the age of 90. Joe, your thoughts?
It is. This one did hit a little different because he was such a larger-than-life character. I mean, just talk about if you were an impressionist, any time in the last 30 years, you had to have a good Sean Connery in your repertoire. If you're auditioning for SNL or, you know, if you're a Frank Caliendo type voice actor. And I just want to plug also this 1986 movie called The Name of the Rose that he did with a really young Christian Slater. And a young Ron Perlman is in it too. And it's a mystery thriller. It's a whodunit that takes place in like 13th century England, and he plays this investigative monk who has to go in and solve the murder at a monastery. It's probably one of the best whodunits I've ever seen, and I would definitely recommend it. He will be missed. Mr. James Bond himself.
It's a good call, Joe. BAFTA, the British Academy Awards, they gave him a Best Actor Award for Name of the Rose. I've never seen it, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's definitely a film that I don't think people have seen enough of, nor have I. So good plug by you there for Sean Connery. All right, one more bit of news here. Father-daughter-son duo Ethan and Maya Hawke. I love this. Maya's been set to lead the romantic coming-of-age comedy Revolver, which is also going to feature her dad. Ethan Hawke, four-time Oscar and Tony nominee, prolific family filmmaker Andrew Stanton. That's right, Finding Dory. He's directing from a script by Kay Treffrey, did Stranger Things. Set in 1966, Maya Hawke will play Jane, a teen resident of Anchorage, Alaska. When the impossible happens, a flight to Japan carrying the Beatles is forced to make an unexpected stop. All hell breaks loose as the unsuspecting residents are consumed by Beatlemania. Jane devises a plan to lose her virginity to George Harrison, discovering that adventure and romance are actually a little closer to home than she thought. Wow. Ethan Hawke's like, all right, sure. I'm going to make a movie with my daughter when she's, you know, trying to lose her virginity to George Harrison. He seems like a very liberal father. I'm sure he's dealt with matters of the heart in much more diplomatic ways than other fathers and sons. Love Ethan Hawke, though. Congrats to him and Maya Hawke getting it done. Murray, Rashida Jones, also Ethan and Maya Hawke that's coming up. But up next after the break, can't wait for this. Erwin Winkler, Life in Movies, stories from 50 years in Hollywood. That's next on Cinephile.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
A fantastic book I just read. It's called A Life in Movies, Stories from 50 Years in Hollywood by Irwin Winkler. That's right. It's a legendary name, a producer who's done some great movies over the years. Rocky, Goodfellas, Raging Bull, The Lovely, The Right Stuff, Creed, and The Irishman. His films have been nominated for 52 Academy Awards, including five movies for Best Picture, and have won 12. He's also been a writer and a director. And like I said, the book is chock full of some amazing stories, and he's kind enough to join us right now. Irwin Winkler, thank you so much for the time today, sir.
It's a pleasure to speak to you.
So the book itself, before we get into some stories, I love the fact that you trim the fat. There's no extraneous, self-indulgent material. It's just the films themselves. You literally hit the ground running. Boom, I'm producing this movie. Then I'm doing Point Blank. Here's a story about Lee Marvin. And away we go. It's funny. It's insightful. I think brevity in so many ways is a strength of the book. Was that always your intent? Hey, if I'm going to write a book, I want a book strictly about the films?
Well, I think it's just my nature, because as a producer and a director, you have to really be on the money when you start out and be specific and try to trim away the fat. Also my memory, going back 50 years, really deals with the highlights of every film rather than some, you know, little nonsense that went on. So those are the stories I remembered clearly, and those are the stories I wrote clearly.
Well, it's one of the best books I've ever read about Hollywood, especially from a producer's account. Like you said, you've written, you've directed, but the producing stories are amazing. And you mentioned in the book your least favorite film to be a part of, but I want to start with the film that I think is your most underappreciated. And we're going to talk a lot about your union with Marty Scorsese and Bob De Niro. But the film I'm referring to is New York, New York. I love the fact that film's a combo of Cassavetes and Vincent Minnelli. The fact that you and Marty both shared an appreciation for those old MGM musicals. You've got intense performances, great jazz, you know, production design from Boris Levin, legendary, an iconic song in New York, New York, which Sinatra made famous. And what I really love is an honest ending. It's not a happy ending, and even though the happy ending song is a big part of it. Have you found, Irwin, that the appreciation for New York, New York has grown over the years?
Well, I think the a lot of, yes, in answer to your question, yes, it has. As a matter of fact, last September, there was September past, September 19, 2019, I was invited to the Venice Film Festival to show New York, New York, which I did. And I was amazed because they had a theater that I say had about 300 or 350 seats, and it was packed with young people. And I don't know if they were attracted to Liza, to Bob, to Marty, or to the song, but they loved the film. It played to applause. And I was just amazed that they sold out, and there were so many young people there. So there is a groundswell for the film, which is, you know, lovely to hear, because when it opened, it was really a lot less successful than we imagined.
Yeah, and I mentioned some of the people involved. Boris Levin, production designer, did Sound of Music, West Side Story. The DP was Laszlo Kovacs. He shot Easy Rider. And Marcia Lucas, George Lucas's wife, who, of course, cut American Graffiti and edited Taxi Driver for Marty, she was a part of it as well. You tell a great story in the book about how Star Wars was impacted by New York, New York, if you can relate it for us.
Well, yeah, it's a lovely story, and it made me very, very proud that George Lucas asked Margot and I, my wife and I, to be the first ones to see Star Wars, and we saw it in the sound mixing room, and the film broke down several times, and my reaction was the next day I went out and bought stock in 20th Century Fox, which was releasing the film.
It's like in school, you need a little more editing time. So George is asking Marcia, hey, can you ask Erwin and Margaret, can I just sneak in the editing bay? I just need to cut a few more things. And so whenever you guys were done, George would sneak in there. And then as a payment, like you said, you get to see the movie, which obviously became a classic. You tell a story, by the way, in New York, about Scorsese's patience, the fact he wanted like 20 takes because he saw, you know, a tear in the eye, one of the performances. I love the scene with De Niro in the hospital. I think that's one of actually Bob's most rawest moments. It's, again, not a film talked about enough, but hopefully people will check out New York, a film that is talked about with reverence and for good reason. Is Raging Bull. It's one of the greatest films of all time. The stories that you tell, once again, everyone check out the book, Erwin Winkler, Life in Movies. The producer didn't want to make the movie, but a guy who he felt was a cockroach. You made a brilliant deal when you said, hey, without Raging Bull, no Rocky II. And we'll get into Rocky in a second. But I love the story you told about Marty's dedication to detail, at one point vowing to take his name off the picture. What was that about?
Well, what happened was we had a release date. We had a theater opening in New York, Toronto, and Los Angeles on a Friday. I don't remember the exact date. And we were in the mixing room, mixing the sound and the music for months. And Marty is that kind of perfectionist. And there are music cues over music cues and little pieces of music. And we were in that mixing room, 14, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for months. And I had arranged for the lab to stay open to print the film on a Sunday night with the idea that we had to get a print to New York on Thursday, so we could show it to the critics and open on Friday. We had to get it a day earlier in Toronto because they had a government viewing, for censorship. And my son was standing by to fly to Toronto with the print under his arm on Wednesday. So I had to get the film in by Sunday night to the lab, and I had the lab staying open. And it came to a little sound when a guy walks up to a bar at the Copacabana, and he orders a cutty sock, the scotch. And Marty said, I can't hear the word cutty sock. And I said, well, we've been here for 4 months, 16 hours a day. None of us could hear anything anymore. We're going crazy. We've been hearing boxing sounds and cannons going off, and which we use for some of the punches. I said, nobody could hear anything, and it's midnight, and the lab is staying, waiting for the print, and it's going, and we're finished. That's it. Picture's over. He said, well, in that case, take my name off the picture. I said, you mean to say for the word cutty sock? He said, if I don't have that in, it's not my movie. I said, well, I guess I'll have to take your name off Raging Bull. Well, obviously, we didn't. And several years later, I was being honored at the Chicago Film Festival, and Marty, who doesn't like to fly, took the train out from New York to Chicago to present the award to me, and they showed a whole bunch of film clips, and sure enough, they ended up showing that Copacabana scene, and the guy walks up to the bar, and he says, I'll have a cutty sock, and Marty holds my hand. He says, you know, I can hear it now.
Oh, that's priceless. We're talking with Erwin Winkler, A Life in Movies, stories from 50 years in Hollywood. Buy it at Barnes & Noble like I did. Buy it online. Buy it for all these great stories. Raging Bull, as you tell in the book, Marty was worried that the use of Cavalleria Rusticana might be too romantic, but it's one of the most indelible sequences in movies, the way he uses that music in that first title sequence. The fact that Marty's old buddy, who co-wrote Mean Streets with him, the first draft is underwhelming. Schrader comes in, writes the second draft, adds the brother, and then Marty and Bob themselves kind of take that script, go in a different direction. I've seen the movie so many times, Erwin. It's a tough movie to watch, but it's a brilliant movie to watch. One thing that I think is always a little bit of a debate, and you mentioned it in the book, when there's that incredibly intense, it's just a gruesome scene to watch when Jake beats Vicky and then goes to his brother's house and just beats Joe Pesci in front of his family. Do you think Vicky actually has relations with Pesci and his friends, or does she just say that because she knows Jake will never let it go? So deep is his jealousy because he's convinced no matter what she says.
You know what? It's hard to answer that because, not only Jake in real life, but Jake the character was very, very complicated, very, very complicated, and very passionate. And part of it is, the question really is, does the fierceness of his boxing and his style and his life really, really affect how he is, or is it the other way around, is who he is makes him that person in the ring and out. And those are things we try to examine within the film.
Well, it's a brilliant movie because it encourages all those rewatchings, and it shows that even though he may be a brutish character, that there is redemption possible. And of course, that goes back to Marty's deep Catholic roots, and obviously all of you combined to make, like, right, I said, one of the great, great films of all time. You've also made, I'm not bearing the lead here, Rocky, which is, you know, the ultimate underdog story, on camera, off camera. I encourage people to read the book again because you're going to want to hear Irwin's stories all about it. But this story in particular, I was laughing at. How do you fill the sports arena with extras? As you wrote in the book, nowadays you could use computers, but not in 1975 and certainly not on our budget. Pick up the story, Irwin. Tell the folks how you made Rocky look like there was tons of people in the crowd.
Well, number one, we didn't have any money. We made the film, for the whole film, for $1 million. And Bob Chartoff and I were on the hook for anything over $1 million. The studio would only give us $1 million. So we try to find ways to obviously keep the budget down. Well, when you do a fight movie, you've got to have a crowd, and you can't just shoot against the black screen. So and we couldn't afford to get to hire a whole bunch of extras. You'd need hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. So what we did is we went to several local nursing homes, and we said, look, we'll take your folks by bus to our movie studio, which was there were two. One was at the MGM studios, and the other one was at an arena, and we will auction off a television set every hour so that your patients that are with us will have an opportunity to buy their own, to win a television set. Also, we will provide snacks for them during the day, and we will give them a box lunch as well. Well, we filled up that place in no time. We had busloads going. The only thing is, at a certain time of the day, we had to give everybody their meds, so that stopped us a little bit. And, of course, we had to stop shooting early because we had to get them back to the nursing home. But that's how we filled up the arena. They had a great time. People won television sets. They got a lot of snacks. They got lunch. And they were on a movie. And we got a big crowd that way.
So smart. And you always come across somebody who's very resourceful. You know, you realize you need a new ending. And they said, well, you got to pay for it yourselves. You're all right, fine. So you and Bob Chartoff did so. That's a great story in the book. And how about what Paddy Chayefsky said to you? This is unbelievable because I do love the film Network and I deeply admire Paddy Chayefsky's script. But after you shared the Best Picture Award from the LA Film Critics with Network, what did Paddy Chayefsky, who was the Network writer, say to you?
Well, what happened is that we were standing next to each other and it was a tie. The film critics gave us both a tie, and I turned to Paddy Chayefsky, who I really didn't know, but just out of politeness, I put up my hand and I said, congratulations, and he looked at me and said, I hope you die, and that was Paddy Chayefsky. Well, I'm still around.
Oh, and that's great news for all of us. Certainly, as you wrote the book, competitive? Yeah, clearly, Paddy Chayefsky did not want to lose. Al Pacino is somebody I deeply admire. I know Revolution did not work out well, but I actually think Author has some good moments. The stories that you tell, by the way, you produced both those films. The stories you told about Author, I mean, this is a great cautionary tale for anybody who thinks, oh, yeah, it's always a harmonious set, you can get through it. Al Pacino and Arthur Hiller did not get along, to put it mildly. And early on, and by the way, I'm going to completely blame Arthur Hiller, not just because I love Pacino. Hiller tells Al that Jack Lemmon could do the scene and wouldn't need to discuss how. This was after Pacino simply asked him how he thought he should play one potential scene. And as you wrote in the book, I was as surprised as Pacino was by Hiller's reaction. From that moment on, I felt as if I was holding my hands out trying to prevent two high-speed trains heading toward each other from colliding. The animosity continued. How were you able to manage this? Tell the story for the people how bad it was between these two guys.
Well, you know, by the time I did Author, I had produced many films, quite a few. You know, we're probably, I don't know, 15 or, you know, maybe 20 films, going from, as you say, an Elvis Presley film to a Lee Marvin film to They Shoot Horses, Don't They, and a film with George Scott and Sly and all that. So I was able to kind of find my way to really get the film finished. And the film had played on television a couple of years ago, and I was surprised how many people admired it. They found it very charming, and now, contrary to everybody thinking he can play a great gangster, he had a great sense of humor, and it was about an extended family, which is now very much on everybody's radar, and we made a good film, and Al and I ended up with a great friendship, and we ended up doing another film afterwards, which was really, really the disaster of my whole career, called Revolution. Then we did the last film together, which was The Irishman.
Let's talk about The Irishman, because I thought, Erwin, it was the best picture of last year and a landmark film, and in so many ways, a culmination, you know, a reckoning. And I read all the stuff leading up to it. I'd heard you, I think, on Mark Maron's podcast when you were promoting this book a year ago, saying, listen, this is a great film, but it's different than Goodfellas, right, in terms of the tonally and stylistically. And I just thought it was such a lovely rumination. You know, it was like one critic, Rebecca Keegan, I believe, called it Scorsese's Unforgiven. You know, it's almost like taking stock of where you are, of what you guys have all contributed to the mob genre. And Marty, for the first time working with Pacino, but reunited with Bob and Pesci, I thought it was such a gorgeous film. And I'll tell you, the scene that I love the most is that Sheeran honorary dinner, because you've got Pacino and Pesci together, then you've got Pesci and De Niro together, and then you've got De Niro and Pacino together. Tell me about that entire sequence, because I could imagine that's where you had all the principal cast there, right? Harvey Keitel's there, Ray Romano's there. That must have been extraordinary to be there on that set.
Well, it was, and it was like a reunion of a family. It was, I think, it's like, I think, the seventh or eighth film I have done with Scorsese in various ways, because I not only produced the film, all those films with him, but I also directed him in the first film that I directed. He was an actor for me. So Marty and I have a 40-some-odd-year relationship. I made my first film with Bob De Niro back in the early 70s, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. Pacino and I go back to Arthur and Revolution. Harvey Keitel, although I never made a movie with him, when my son David directed a film, Harvey was the star of it back some 10, 12 years ago. So it really was like a big family all coming together. The crew was also pretty much the same crew we used both on The Wolf of Wall Street and Silence, as far as the cameramen and assistant directors, all the principals. So the set was really, really, as I say, it was like walking into your living room every day and seeing your best friends hanging out. I think the film showed some of that, showed the friendship between the different individuals and the warmth between them, although they were all, you know, gangsters and killing people, amongst themselves they were very, very heartfelt and felt that way. And I think that's how the script, that was basically how the set felt as well. It was a pleasure to make that movie.
340 scenes, about twice the number of most films, hundreds of locations to find. Amazing work by you, Emma Koskoff, and the entire crew. You mentioned the film that I think is, again, very overlooked, and maybe it was just timing sometimes that happens. But I think years from now, people are going to say that film is a masterpiece. And I'm talking about 2016's Silence. As you wrote in the book, once again, people, buy the book, A Life in Movies, Stories from 50 Years in Hollywood by Erwin Winkler. The critical response was generally excellent, with some carping about the length and violence. That might have hurt our holiday release. By the way, I was living in Connecticut at the time. I drove 2 hours to the city in New York to go watch the film. And I watched that film, and this was Christmas Day, and I was I was paralyzed afterwards. It was such an emotional film for me to watch. I'm going to continue with what you were reading here. However, in my opinion and most others, Silence is a great artistic success. I believe it's Marty Scorsese's best film. Unfortunately, audiences still did not flock to see it. It was pretty well ignored by the Academy. Still, I believe that Silence will stand alongside some of the best Ingmar Bergman, Fellini, and Pasolini films. I could not agree with you more. I think it's an extraordinary piece of work. Why do you feel so passionate about it?
Well, I think because it deals with a lot of people's feelings about how they relate to something beyond the material aspects of life. And it's a film dealing with a very, very profound question about religion and where we stand in religion as individuals and what it could mean to you. So it's obviously not a popular subject for film, but I think it was something Marty wanted to make for 40 years. And I came on the scene about 15 years before we made it and made all our efforts. None of us got paid. We all spent quite a bit of time in Taipei, left our homes to make this film. And I think it's just an extraordinary film. And it was surprisingly really, really dismissed by the audience, maybe because it required a lot more thought than most people expected after The Wolf of Wall Street.
You mentioned The Wolf of Wall Street, so let's talk about that. I mean, what a rollicking adventure it was. It's a really funny movie. Again, as you wrote in the book, Marty rehearsed the actors in phone conversations that were the smooth as silk or agitated to the point of a slammed down phone. The actors, of course, never took drugs or drank liquor that might affect their acting, but Jonah Hill snorted such a great amount of fake drugs that he got so sick he couldn't work for days. The reality went too far in one crazy scene where an actress had to be dismissed when she came on to Leo too enthusiastically in a supposedly simulated sex scene. What happened there?
You know, I think somebody went a little too far, and Leo is a very, very attractive person, not only as an actor but as a human being. So those things happen occasionally. They don't happen as much as you would expect them to happen. You know, you have to deal with it, and that's part of what you do as a producer.
Yeah, and that's what, listen, I get that feeling over and over, like producers don't get enough love. I think of Dustin Hoffman's great performance in Wag the Dog, which many feel he's doing a send-up of Robert Evans. But that, like, why isn't there an Oscar for producing? Everyone knows what directors do, what actors do, what cinematographers do, screenwriters, but producers do so much work. And in reading your book, I think the greatest benefit that I learned is just how resourceful you have to be. Like, put simply, a producer reads a book, finds source material, hires a screenwriter to adapt it, finds a director, finds an actor. And I thought what you did a great job of pointing out is this. You have a great friendship with Bob De Niro. You've done a lot of work with him. But oftentimes when you ask an actor, either A, they're busy, they've got another project they're shooting. B, it's in between projects, so they don't have time to read your script. C, they've got, like, you know, maybe a family vacation or something else planned. Like, it's awfully hard just to get people even to read the script, much less getting an answer. And this is from people you've known for years, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And so I guess where my question is this. Where do you find the resilience? You know, 50-plus years, so many incredible films. Where do you find just the stamina, the chutzpah, to keep grinding through this this crazy thing called movies?
Well, let me say this. A, I don't know anything else, so I have a singular job, and always have. I love making movies. I don't love it any less now than I did 50 years ago. I still get a great, great thrill the first day of shooting. And I spent, you know, quite a few years directing movies. That was a great experience for me. Writing the book was a great experience, and it's really surrounded my life. And frankly, it's given me a very, very good life. I still love making movies. We have plans to make a Creed 3 right now with Michael B. Jordan directing it. We're planning to do a musical based on George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. So I'm still in the middle of putting together movies and enjoying it. I wake up in the morning and I can't wait to get started on the next movie. Never bored.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow you get it done. And by the way, people read the book again. The stories about Creed are fascinating, how you were able to trust, you know, bringing that story to life once again, and Apollo Creed's son, and why that was able to be so successful. And again, trusting the people around you, a young, vibrant director, a big star, Michael B. Jordan. Before we close, I just think this was a great story. I don't want to go in depth on DeLovely, but tell us how humble and down-to-earth Giorgio Armani is. I couldn't believe this story when he went and fitted out Kevin Kline.
Well, it was, you know, I always thought of Mr. Armani as this big, you know, magnet with, you know, hundreds of stores and a great label and a great reputation, cover of Time magazine. And when he agreed to do the costumes for free, by the way, on DeLovely, Kevin Kline and I flew to Milan, where he has his offices and his atelier, his workrooms. And I thought, well, you know, he sits behind this big desk and everybody is running around. And sure enough, we got into this room, and he had plenty of people standing around. And there he was with pins in his mouth and a piece of chalk in his hand. He got down on his knees, and he's cuffing the pants that Kevin Kline is wearing. And he's using pins to make it a little tighter around the waist. I couldn't believe it. This is what he was, a tailor. And there was this Giorgio Armani as a tailor. And then I said to him, you know, we really need a wedding dress for Ashley Judd's character. And he said, well, what year did they get married? And I told him. And he took out a big pad and a piece of crayon, and he drew this incredible dress that he then had manufactured for her, all within a couple of minutes. But here he was, a tailor, the kind of tailor that you would think you would go into a store on Columbus Avenue in New York and bring in your pants to get fixed, and the guy would do it, and there's Armani doing it the same way. And I think that's the strength of why he's so successful, because he actually does the work, does the work. And by the way, I think that's true of everything. I think it's true, if you ask me how being a producer, what do? You do the work. You do the work.
Do the work. And I love the way you close this, by the way. I posted on Instagram, and I got a lot of people commenting on it. This was in your acknowledgments after you mentioned Margot and your kids. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. For boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. That's by Goethe. Once again, Erwin Winkler, A Life in Movies, Stories from 50 Years in Hollywood. An incredible career. I encourage everyone to check out the book. And I can't thank you enough for being so gracious and rewarding us with your time. Thanks again.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And stay safe.
Mount Rushmore.
All right, thanks once again, Erwin Winkler, absolute legend in the annals of Hollywood. Mount Rushmore, a father and daughter movies. Well, Father of the Bride is obviously a no-brainer. Not just Steve Martin, hilarious in the role, but also Franck there, Martin Short. I mean, a Canadian legend. One of his best performances, so funny, is The Wedding Planner. He's amazing. I'm, of course, going to put in hardcore with a nod to my man Scott Rogowski, Paul Schrader film, George C. Scott, playing a father trying to rescue his daughter, who's left him and is in the porn industry. I mean, one of the most disturbing, but also very funny and entertaining movies in its own sick, demented way. 1979's a hardcore. I'm laughing because, yeah, that's not what you'd expect in a father-daughter list, but I'm going with it. Little Miss Sunshine, I think, is a great father-daughter movie. Greg Kinnear, Tony Collette, Steve Carell, Paul Dano, Abigail Breslin, Alan Arkin. I mean, that's about as well-cast a movie as it gets. 06 was not a strong year for movies. People point to the fact that Departed won Best Picture isn't necessarily a great movie. Well, the only movie that really had a chance of upsetting it, maybe Babel, but also Little Miss Sunshine, which I think is definitely a movie that still endures. I'd love to watch it again. What a great movie. It's got such charm about that movie, right? So those are the three in that list. And then the one more I'm going to go with, I was kind of thinking about To Kill a Mockingbird. Obviously, the relationship there, Gregory Peck and his daughter, Scout. But I'm going to go with The Descendants. I really liked that movie a lot. Alexander Payne, impeccably written and directed. Liked the chemistry with George Clooney, Shailene Woodley. You know, a widower who's dealing with a lot of anger and frustration against his wife. I think that actually was really kind of true to life in many ways, the way a lot of relationships can be. You know, marriage can be messy, but oftentimes it works for the right reasons. So I'm going to go with The Descendants. An honorable mention to Kill a Mockingbird. Also, Paper Moon, I want to give an honorable mention. Tatum O'Neill won an Oscar. Peter Bogdanovich movie, fantastic. Little Miss Sunshine, a hardcore, and Father of the Bride. Joe, I hope you go with Old Boy here in your father-daughter list.
You know what? Yeah, I'll go with Old Boy for my father-daughter for doing the not-so-typical father-daughter movies. It is a very good movie. It just, you know, it's a punch in the gut, I will say, to say the very least, about Old Boy. So I'll go with Old Boy. I will back you up on Father of the Bride. Steve Martin has to be my favorite comedian of all time, ever. So he's definitely on the list. And, you know, for the sake of variety, I guess I will go with Despicable Me. I know it's about a villain. I know he's not actually their father. But, you know, it's three orphans who want him to be their father. So I'll throw that on. And then my last one is this Korean horror movie called Train to Busan. It's notorious for being, like, one of the all-time greatest Korean horror movies to be made. It's a zombie movie, but it's about this father and his daughter trying to escape zombies after zombies on a train. It's exactly what it sounds like. So mine are Train to Busan, Father of the Bride, Despicable Me, and Old Boy, I guess.
I love the fact I strong armor there into Old Boy. Thanks as always for listening to Cinephob. Please give us your suggestions, your Mount Rushmore father-daughter movies. As always, you can tweet us at @NanSFurk or CinephilePod, or of course go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate, and review. Thanks once again to Joe getting it done. Before we close up shop here, Joe, I want you to tell the story why you moved again in a rare moment of you losing your temper.
Oh, man, Adnan. So we've been working together for a while now, and, you know, the way I describe myself is I'm pretty even keel. You know, I'm like room temperature water. It takes a lot for me to get to a boil. It takes a lot for me to freeze. I'm never too high, never too low. I was losing my mind. So I moved. This is the third time I've moved this year. The first time, it's because my lease was up and I needed to find a new place. Very natural thing. The second time, this pandemic has hit tons of Americans in different ways. My roommates had to break the lease because they had lost their income. Understandable thing. This one was just pure deception. So my now former roommate, I guess she didn't feel that she could fill the room if she had disclosed that her boyfriend was living there full time. So I move in, I'm a new roommate, another person moves in, they're a new roommate, and about 2 weeks in, I have a conversation with my roommate. I say, hey, let's call him Kyle. I'll be like, hey, do you know if Kyle lives here full time? Because he has not left the apartment. I haven't said one word to him. It's just kind of weird. So we eventually talk. We gather that he is not on the lease. He is not a roommate in the apartment, and that we were essentially duped. So we have a house meeting, and in this meeting, I lose my mind because this person isn't being remorseful anyway. They're not giving me an explanation. And so I yell at this person. I'm just like, who raised you? Why would you do this? Why, you know, like, I had to move in, you know, just like tearing into this person. Eventually, everything worked out. I was able to get a rent reduction for everyone else, but at that point, I had already decided to leave. Luckily, my friend, also he happened to be looking for a new apartment at that time. This person I trust and have lived with in the past. So now we have moved to a new apartment in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I moved from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, north up to Greenpoint on the Queens-Brooklyn border. Love the neighborhood, love the new apartment. Everything I could possibly need is within a block, Adnan. But I am telling you right now, I was absolutely livid at this person for deceiving us.
The fact that you said, who raised you? I mean, you were at the level of condescending anger to this person. I mean, just assuming, like a Kato Kaelin, like a live-in boyfriend. Like, wait, who is this person? You got to give me a heads up. I couldn't imagine how you were dealing with this.
Oh, yeah, no. And the thing was, too, like, this boyfriend living there wasn't contributing to utilities or rent. So we were also saying, listen, we're paying for him to essentially be a freeloader in our apartment. We're paying for his utilities, and we're paying for him to be here. So you have to understand, either he leaves or all of our rents go down. And so the latter is what actually ended up happening. But at that point, I had made up my mind where I was just like, you know, it's the pandemic. All I want is stable housing right now. I don't think that's too unfair to ask. And so, yeah, that's kind of what happened. I'd lost my mind, Adnan. Just completely yelled at this person.
Well, listen, I'm glad you figured it out. Still in Brooklyn. I still like when you were in Bed-Stuy, but at least you're still in Brooklyn now. And, hey, man, onward and upward. Thanks as always to Joe. Great job, even under duress. Thank you to Erwin Winkler, legendary producer, director, and writer. And thanks most of all to all of you. Stay safe. Election week. Hey, man, let's just get through this. And we'll talk to you again. I will see you at the movies.